This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll dig into today's arraignment of former President Donald Trump in a New York court, and you can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, and your questions about what exactly is going on. First, we're going to take a break, a breather from that big news of the day. A well-known character is making his return to the big screen tomorrow.
It's me, Mario.
The Super Mario Brothers movie hits theaters fully animated and sporting a big-name cast. No offense to Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo from the original live-action movie. The Mario reboot has gotten a lot of attention. It's the latest in a trend of more video games receiving the adaptation treatment for film or TV. Think Sonic the Hedgehog, Pokemon Detective Pikachu, and The Last of Us. Is it a sign of things to come for movies and TV? What makes a good adaptation? Could Mario be it? We're going to get into all of that, as well as some of the history and legacy of the friendly and legendary plumber. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have Mario or Super Mario or Mario Kart memories to share? Did you grow up playing some version of the game or his first appearance way back in a game called Donkey Kong? Did you get into the series later at light? Did your kids play it? Do you want to see your favorite video game, whatever it might be, turned into a movie or a long-running TV show? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Brian Carr is Associate Professor of Communication, Information Science, and Women and Gender Studies at UW Green Bay. He's author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm really excited.
You're a fan of video games. You teach about them. Do you feel the hype? Do you feel the buzz? Are you excited to see this new Mario movie?
I'm looking forward to checking it out. I'm not sure when I'm going to get a chance, but it's definitely been kind of interesting to see all this stuff that has been sort of codified into my youth and, let's be honest, my adulthood and probably well into my old age, kind of manifesting in this sort of really big, accessible spectacle.
I don't want to age ourselves here. My first Mario encounter, though, was in Donkey Kong, running Mario up those ramps and failing to dodge barrels mostly. When did you first encounter Mario, Super or otherwise?
I'd have to be in the Super variety on the original Nintendo Entertainment System back in the mid to late 80s. I got mine fairly young. One of the things that helped me learn how to read at a young age was those instruction manuals. So definitely have a long standing history with this character in particular.
Now, Mario, in some ways, you could say he's the most iconic video game character of all time. What is it about Mario that has sustained him through all these different games and even kinds of games over the decades?
So I think there's a couple things about Mario that make him so unique in that regard. First off is the fact that he's a very warm, inviting character. He's not edgy. He's by definition not cool, and that's very important. He is just a sort of everyman that anybody, and that was from the intent or beginning. That was the intent. He was designed to be an everyman that could be ported into a bunch of different scenarios and situations, whether he is fixing pipes with his brother or trying to bring a gorilla back to the zoo or even becoming a doctor dishing out, medical treatment, which even the creator of Mario has kind of hinted may or may not have been legitimate. He's really just a malleable character that can fit into a variety of different situations.
Now, here in the United States, I haven't really thought about this before. He's portrayed as an Italian American plumber, mm-hmm. but this is a game made in Japan. Like, does he read the same way there, or does he fit a different sort of cultural norm in other countries around the world?
So the interesting thing about Mario is that he is sort of a part of a long-standing tradition of characters created in Japan that were designed to be what's known as culturally odorless, right? They're not really identified as being from specifically that country of origin. So Mario is a character who was created in Japan, he was sort of determined to be Italian through just over time, and specifically from New York and Brooklyn. His adventures take him to this sort of like European kind of medieval fantasy inspired world. There's elements in his other games where he'll travel to country levels inspired by different countries and cultures. So there's a term in Japanese called Mukokaseki. I apologize, maybe not having the best pronunciation of that, where it's basically a character who is designed to appeal to a variety of different cultural contexts. And Mario, because of the way he was constructed, the way he was built, primarily as that everyman, he was designed through hardware limitations more than anything else to be this very sort of bright and iconic and identifiable character with very pronounced and sort of recognizable features. He just appeals, like, you know, he doesn't speak, he doesn't require like a lot of sort of cultural knowledge or background to understand. He's just, here's Mario. He's your friend. We're going to go on an adventure together. It's great.
Talking to Brian Carr from UW Green Bay about Mario, a.k.a. Super Mario, and a new movie coming out, just about to come out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or did you have a connection with Mario and the many, many games that have come out over the years featuring him and his cast of friends and relatives? Do you like video game to movie adaptations? Are there video games or computer games that you would like to see turned into a movie? How about that Last of Us TV show? Was that a successful jump? How about those Resident Evil movies? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, on the video game to movie theme, let's check out the earlier attempt. This is back in 1993. Not well regarded very much. Here's a brief clip of John Leguizamo as Luigi and Bob Hoskins as Mario. They're in a car chase here, driving a stolen police cruiser.
Security alert. Stand by for special bulletin.
Mario, look! You look terrible!
You don't look so good yourself.
Alien species escaping from police detention.
Aliens? Well, we gotta deal with aliens too?
Luigi, we're the aliens!
Yeah? Whoa! Cool!
Now, Brian, I don't think things are usually unanimous in the film critic and fan world, but I think most people agreed that they didn't like this particular Mario to movie version, right?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because there has been a sort of fan reappraisal of this film in recent years, with a lot of people considering it a secret, sort of subversive masterpiece. I don't think I'm prepared to go that far personally. I remember watching this movie at the height of my Nintendo fandom and at the height of my uncritical approach to film when I was like, you know, five or so, eight, whatever. And just thinking, this movie's bad. Like, this is not a thing I'm enjoying. Yeah, things have changed a lot. That movie was definitely made by people who had a vague understanding of what the source material entails, but not necessarily how to turn it into a larger film. And that's actually one of the kind of long-standing issues with film adaptations of video games in general.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. CK is with us in Whitefish Bay. CK, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, CK?
I was calling to bring up that I would like to see God of War Kratos on the big screen.
Okay, the God of War Kratos video game. Now, I'm flipping through IMDb. There's a movie called God of War. It's Chinese. I don't think it has anything to do with that video game. So, yeah, people often want to see, Brian, their favorite video games turned into movies. Are you seeing a movement toward that these days, more where CK's dream might come true?
Well, I can tell CK that Amazon has actually ordered a God of War TV show. So, yes, there is definitely a lot of interest. So Hollywood loves to adapt existing properties. We saw this with the Marvel and DC movies most recently. There were those adaptations. In fact, we just saw a trailer for a Barbie movie that's coming out soon. So if there's a built-in audience, there's a known quantity, something they can associate the movie with. They love looking for that. And video games have recently become one of those venues they're really trying to dig into more, thanks to the success of some of the things we're talking about right now. Thanks. But yeah, God of War will be coming, CK.
Thanks a lot for that call, CK, at 800-642-1234. Now, it really depends on the video game a lot, doesn't it? Like, some video games and computer games have really interesting plots and characterization, and some, you know, have more and more complicated obstacle courses that the hero runs through. Does that tie our hands if we're trying to make a video game movie out of something that doesn't have a lot in the way of plot?
It absolutely does. So The Last of Us has often been held up as the thing that broke the video game adaptation curse. I take issue with that because we have had some really great adaptations of video games in the past. I think it also kind of short sells the ability of video games to tell stories as a medium into itself. But Let's talk about why The Last of Us was so successful. The Last of Us was so successful because the structure of that game is basically the structure that they followed for the first season of that TV show. Each episode of that show corresponds roughly to a major arc or a major part from that game, with the exception of the third episode, which they largely constructed for the show, and ironically is probably the best part of that show. So that was this thing where the game part was almost secondary to the narrative and the structure of the narrative as a sort of cinematic or television story. Whereas with a game like Mario, as you mentioned, it's less about the narrative. The narrative is not the main plot. The narrative is there as window dressing to explain why things happen. If I pick up this mushroom, why do I get bigger? Right? It is not the main thrust. The main thrust of the reason you play that game is for the sense of challenge, the sense of exploration and discovery, and to kind of, you know, get better times, get better scores, that kind of thing. Whereas The Last of Us, your primary motive for playing that game is to see the story through. So a story-driven game is sort of by definition easier to translate over than a game that isn't. And the other issue with games turning into film in general is that games are really kind of motivated more through challenge. We become associated with characters or attached to characters because we project ourselves onto them and our stories kind of become intertwined. So it's harder to kind of create that and turn that into an actual, you know, three-part arc, as opposed to if I'm going to spend 60 hours playing Mario and getting all the secrets, what story have I told other than the one that I've kind of made for myself?
Now, I can't leave this hanging there. You mentioned that there have been successful, in your view, past video game movie adaptations. Name some names.
I will absolutely name some names. So I am of an age where I remember when video game movies were uniformly bad. If a video game movie came out, it was essentially synonymous with this movie is bad. Now, there were some, you know, people loved that original Mortal Kombat that came out in the early 90s. Largely because they were very smart and just ripped off Enter the Dragon. So if a good recipe for the early ones is like, if you're going to adapt a movie, find a better movie and just make a knockoff of that. It worked. Since then, we have seen some instances. The Detective Pikachu movie was very successful, at least critically, in part because they decided rather than adapt the traditional story of the Pokemon games, we're going to take a sort of side game, a side story, and then just do like sort of a mystery kind of science fiction movie, as opposed to, hey, this kid's gonna go on a journey, find a bunch of Pokemon. We're gonna instead tell the story about a father and son trying to reconnect, and Pokemon kind of is the sort of backdrop for that. So finding those more human stories is a good way to kind of make those things successful. The other movie that's really been successful is Sonic the Hedgehog. The Sonic the Hedgehog movies were surprise hits. Sonic has been a reliably popular franchise, especially with young kids, ever since he was created in the early 90s. But these movies kind of hit on it because, again, they are essentially superhero movies for kids. And, you know, as much as superhero movies should be for kids, they often aren't. So a Sonic the Hedgehog movie where you have a character with superpowers who goes on these crazy adventures, but also is very identifiable and accessible to young people, makes that really successful. And of course, you also have the Resident Evil series, which has almost nothing to do with the games it's based on, but instead uses the sort of backdrop of evil corporation creates zombie virus to instead tell a bunch of very just very over the top crazy action stories.
We're talking about the new Mario Brothers movie, as well as video game adaptations for TV and movies. Brian Carr is with us, Associate Professor of Communication, Information Science, and Women and Gender Studies at UW Green Bay. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond memories of playing any or many of the Mario and Super Mario line of games over the years? Do you want to see them made into a movie somehow? Are there other video game movies that you have liked or much less than liked? Are there games, computer games, video games that you want to see turned into a movie or TV show? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Brian Carr, Associate Professor at UW Green Bay, talking about the history and legacy of Mario ahead of the new animated features release tomorrow and the larger trend of video game adaptations for TV and movies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite video game to movie adaptation? Do you have one you want to see? Do you want to play more Mario? Are you a big Mario fan from time immemorial? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Trevor is with us in Milwaukee. Trevor, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to see?
I think Grand Theft Auto should be a movie.
Yeah, now, Grand Theft Auto, Trevor, it seems like that's one that was pretty heavily influenced by a lot of movies. Do you think there's stuff, there? You want more of it, and you think there's a good story to tell based on the game itself?
Well, I think we need more violence in this day and age, quite frankly.
I got you, Trevor. Thanks a lot for the call. It's interesting, and Brian, Grand Theft Auto, a game, mm-hmm. a very immersive game where you do lots of crimesing. What do you think about that idea?
I mean, again, as you correctly pointed out, Grand Theft Auto is a series heavily influenced by film. You look at something like Grand Theft Auto Vice City, Scarface is all over that one. San Andreas is heavily influenced by films like Boys in the Hood and that kind of thing. It would not be a huge jump to see Grand Theft Auto make that leap. And I think in a lot of ways, it would just become the question of what do you add to a Grand Theft Auto movie? Is it simply a crime story? Is it a satire? Is it both? So I think the challenge would be, how do you take something where the game is trying to tell you one story and the gameplay is letting you do something else in many cases, and create a sort of cohesive, creative vision for that? And I don't believe there's been any large conversation. Apparently, there was at one point an attempt to bring Eminem into a Grand Theft Auto movie, but I don't think that went anywhere.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We've heard from a couple of people, Brian, who couldn't stay on the line, who offered their movies they'd like, or video games they'd like to see turn into movies. Jeremy and Potosi mentioned Final Fantasy VII. The mm-hmm. ending was great, Jeremy says, should be a movie. I don't know. What do you think? So that's one people are really immersed in. But just having played the game and seen the ending spoil the movie, or vice versa? I don't know.
And that's always one of the great challenges of adaptation, right? What can you add that is unique enough for people who have already seen the story and experienced it to enjoy it, but also does not necessarily violate what they expect, right? So we're actually seeing the story of Final Fantasy VII be retold and reimagined in games right now with the Final Fantasy VII remake. My question would be, if you have a story that is that big and that sprawling that takes over 60 hours, what do you cut? And that's one of the great challenges of taking these big immersive games and saying, how can we take this 60-hour story and cut it down to two, 2.5? Even a trilogy would be very difficult.
Back to our callers with Jake on the line in Hudson. Jake, hello.
Howdy. I really enjoyed the Halo Forward Unto Dawn prequel series that Netflix did.
And Jake, did you play or do you play the Halo video games?
I was, I think, 3 when it first came out, but my oldest sister dated and ended up marrying a guy that really got me into it when I was in my teenage years. I'm 27 now. And yeah, I love Halo, and they took the prequel, so it didn't interfere with any of the current games.
Jake, I gotcha. Thanks. And Brian, that's an interesting approach, saying, mm-hmm. okay, yes, we're going to play in that universe. We're going to do a movie. It's not going to run up against, you know, the narrative of the game. The prequel or postquel or side story idea could be a good strategy.
It definitely could. And we have had some instances. The Assassin's Creed movie, for instance, is part of the larger mythology of that franchise without directly adapting or undoing one of the games. Now, that movie wasn't very good. But that is another approach you could take. And in a sort of transmedia environment where we're trying to tell stories across multiple platforms, doing that prequel, that side story could be a way to go. They did actually do a Halo TV show, but one of the challenges with adapting that is that you have a main character in Master Chief that consciously does not show his face because he's meant to be a player avatar. They showed his face. They gave him a backstory. They gave him a personality. The show was not super well received by a lot of fans, and that's a big part of why. Which is, again, one of those challenges when you have already created an idea of who this character is in your mind, can recasting that with an actor really match up to that?
Thanks for that call. Stuart is with us now in Madison. Stuart, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to say I am a huge fan of the original Super Mario Brothers movie from the 90s. But one game I've always wanted to see, and I know they're working on it, but I haven't heard much about it in recent years, Metal Gear Solid would be really mm-hmm. cool to see on the screen.
Yeah, I'm seeing on IMDb Oscar Isaac attached to it, but very, very little information. Brian, you nodded along there. What do you know about that?
I'm a huge Metal Gear fan. I would love to see this made. And that's another movie, that game that draws heavily from cinematic influences. Hideo Kojima has not been shy about saying that, you know, he, you know, in a lot of ways, he probably wishes he was a film director instead of a game designer most days. But you can see the influence of a lot of different films. I mean, right down to the character Solid Snake being almost a direct lift of Kurt Russell from the Escape From movies. You know, again, how they will adapt that large sprawling narrative into a movie remains to be seen. But casting Oscar Isaac would be a good start as Solid Snake. I think that that shows they're at least in the right direction.
Stuart, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Brian, a bunch of movies scheduled to come out, Gran Turismo, Fallout, Twisted Metal. There are more. A lot of things we've mentioned have at least something in the works. Are video games, I've seen other people ask this, are video games going to be the new, you know, superhero universe franchise movies?
I think we are headed in that direction, especially if you are a Sega fan. The success of Sonic the Hedgehog has led to a lot of adaptation requests and a lot of work on films like the one I'm most excited for is the Yakuza franchise. I'm a big fan of that series. There's already a movie in development for that. Space Channel 5. I think there's a Golden Axe or Streets of Rage movie out there.
No,
these
way.
Are all things that just excite me at the sort of lizard brain level. So I'm really excited.
Wait, Golden Axe?
Golden Axe, yes. Wow. I believe there was discussion of a Golden Axe movie, because I was always joked like, oh yeah, they're gonna do Golden Axe next, and I think they actually are working on a Golden Axe movie. So at least I know for sure the Streets of Rage one is happening, so maybe I'm getting those wires crossed, but or maybe it's just I'm trying to manifest that in the universe. And I think if Mario does well, they will definitely be interested in approaching things like Zelda and other big Nintendo franchises. And Nintendo has a lot of movies and a lot of characters they have not yet leveraged in this way.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's Brian Carr from UW Green Bay. We talked to him about the cultural history of the video game star Mario and how we're seeing lots more video game adaptations for movies and TV. I laughed with Golden Axe. That is the video arcade game that ate more of my quarters back when video games ate quarters than any other. My buddies and I used to just feed it until we could actually complete the whole thing. Golden Axe movie? We'll see. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, spring is a great time to visit a Wisconsin state park. Get some recommendations and share your favorite springtime state park trips. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the first attempt by a Republican-led state to restrict drag shows has been blocked by a judge. With drag artists under attack, does the First Amendment protect their right to perform? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, former President Donald Trump was arraigned in a New York courtroom today on 34 felony charges of falsifying business records. The charges stem from Trump's alleged cover-up of a hush money payment to an adult film actress in 2016. He entered a plea of not guilty on all counts. It's the first time a former U.S. president has faced criminal charges. Police presence was heavy in and around the courtroom. Outside, a few hundred protesters, including earlier in the day, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene demonstrated in support of Trump, along with some counter-protesters. We're talking about what we learned today, what to expect next, and some of the political reaction. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the legal aspects, maybe the nuances of this case, how things work in these charges against the former president? How are you feeling about a former president being charged with these crimes? If you voted for Donald Trump in the past, does this case sway your feelings about voting for him again, one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I understand you've had a chance to read through the complaints since they were released earlier today. What did you learn there?
What I learned was something quite interesting here is that keep in mind that she's not being charged with making a hush money payout. Right. What he's being charged with here is 34 counts under New York state law where it's basically business fraud. And what the legal argument is that when he made the payments to Stormy Daniels and another person. What he did was to try to conceal those payments through the Trump Organization by falsely listing them as payments for legal services or for other types of activities, but mostly legal services. So at the end of the day, what the Manhattan County DA is saying is that under New York state law, if you are committing a state crime, and the state crime here was illegally promoting a candidate for office, if you're doing something illegal, then try to cover it up, we can charge you under New York state fraud laws for the fraud that occurred. And here, the reason why it's 34 counts is that Trump, through Michael Cohen, made multiple payments, not one check, but multiple payments and multiple false entries in business books in order to conceal that payment.
Now, I'm going to read from the counts here. Now, this is a phrase that appears in many of these counts,
right,
that the defendant, and I'm quoting here, with intent to defraud and intent to commit another crime and aid and conceal the commission thereof, made and caused a false entry in the business records of an enterprise. Now, this seems key to me, David. I'm not a law talking guy, but if it was without that intent to deceive and it's just a false entry, I believe that would be something you could charge as a misdemeanor. That other crime, that covering up another crime or intent to commit another crime, is a big part of this and why it can be charged as a felony. Do I have this right?
Exactly. You have it correct here. I don't want to use the old phrase that sometimes it's not the deed, but it's the effort to conceal the deed, or not the crime, but the cover up, to use an old phrase here. That's exactly what's going on here, is that it was the cover up that is really the problem here. It was the effort to try to hide the fact that this underlying payment was being made to essentially to Stormy Daniels and so forth. That's really a big problem here. So that's that ratchets it from a misdemeanor to a felony. And just so people understand, under New York state law, a felony under New York state statute 175, it is punishable up to 4 years in prison. So we're now looking at 34 counts, each of which carry a maximum of 4 years in prison. Now, does that mean if he were convicted, it's going to be 4 times 34? Unlikely it would be that, but these are a lot of charges for felony fraud.
Now, this seems like a potential weakness in the case, David. For that just misdemeanor charge, it seems like fairly easy to prove, if this isn't what former President Trump did, prove that he made false statements. But if it's to cover up a crime, and this was something that reporters asked the prosecutor here afterwards, he's not being prosecuted for those crimes that he's alleged to have covered up. So there's a chicken or egg thing. Do you see that as a potential line of attack from the former president's defense?
That is potential. And that's one of the things, it was my law students that we were talking to about this today as we were watching it and reading it through, is that you don't have to prove the primary crime, that is a federal violation or a state violation, New York state violation of election law, in order to be able to charge with the fraud here. That seems counterintuitively odd, but my understanding of New York state law, fraud law, and this is actually one of the statutes that I teach in one of my classes here, is that it's fairly commonplace to use this type of ratcheting up, even though you don't have to prove that the primary violation actually the person is guilty of. It seems very odd to me, but the courts have upheld that.
Talking to Dave Schultz from the law school at the University of Minnesota, looking at today's arraignment of former President Trump. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hello. What do you think?
Well, I'm very excited. I've been waiting 6 years for somebody to make him accountable for something. And so I'm just hoping, but I'm sort of afraid that he's going to get away with it again. I don't know why. I don't know how he can escape 34 counts. I think he has to be, they have to charge him with something. But anyway, I'm very excited that they're finally doing something about him.
Connie, thanks a lot for the call. These are not, I think, slam dunk charges, David, if this goes to trial. I, for one, wouldn't put a lot of money on it going one way or the other. Connie is worried that the president wouldn't be convicted here.
That's a concern. Remember, we should always start with the presumption in our society of innocence until proven guilty. Donald Trump deserves the exact same presumption. We're going to have to see the actual evidence as it unfolds when the trial occurs. It's sounding like the trial might not be for about 9 months from now. But if I want to make Connie feel a little bit happier and try to stay neutral on this, if you go and download the statement of facts, and I believe it's paragraph 41 where it says, in talking about the underlying payoffs here, it says, ultimately, the other participants in the scheme admitted that the payoffs were unlawful. My students and I agree that in the statement of fact, paragraph 41 is incredibly critical, because here you have the admission of the underlying crime. So if you're worried about that linkage, there you have it there. On top of which, again, as I'm starting to look at some of the evidence as it's being unfolded here, again, this was not one check that was being cut. It was multiple checks over many months. And so, again, still not going to say that it's a slam dunk, because it's not, and not a problematic case. But as I'm reading it through and listening to Bragg this afternoon, as the prosecutor, it sounds like they have quite a bit of evidence at this point. It's obviously going to go up to a jury, and I think it's going to be interesting, especially if Donald Trump testifies. How's a jury going to view Donald Trump, Michael Cohen? I don't know if Stormy Daniels is going to testify. I think that becomes interesting in terms of who believes whom.
Thanks for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I, like you, I'm listening intently to the evidence and everything that's presented. And myself, I support Trump. I think what he did was not illegal. And if I was serving on a jury, the way I see this is he paid his lawyer fees. And there's nothing illegal about paying your lawyer fees. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. David.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. I think part of what this case is going to hinge upon is that, was he paying legitimate legal fees, or did he conceal another crime by describing this as legal fees? And that's what we're going to have to see the evidence as it unfolds. And unless that caller who just called in happens to be a Manhattan County resident, he won't be on the jury. I won't be on the jury, of course. It's going to be eventually, what do the jurors sitting in this box, what evidence do they see, and how they're going to weigh it? And I think that's critical. So I think the caller is absolutely correct that it's going to hinge upon, what was this payment really for, and can we believe Trump or Cohen, or whom can we believe, and what kind of documents are there? That's why we have trials.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We're talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at the criminal charges facing former President Trump, his arraignment in court earlier today. You can join in with your reactions, your questions about how this all works at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota, looking at today's arraignment of former President Trump and the charges against him. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, before we go back to our callers, one of President Trump's legal team has said, we're not going to do a plea for a lesser crime, but also hinted that they don't expect that this case will necessarily end up in trial. What are some of the other ways that this case could not end up going to trial? I guess moving to dismiss these charges and asking the judge to do that?
They could do that, yes. They could argue that as a matter of law, they could first say that the prosecutor doesn't have a case here and move very quickly at that point. And I expect them to do that. They could also, maybe after they do some initial sharing of evidence, which they're going to require to do. Prosecutor is required under the Constitution to provide Trump with all the evidence that they're going to use. Maybe at that point, they make a motion for a dismissal of the case, for summary judgment to have the case dismissed. So I think that's where they're aiming for at this point, is to say that we think there's an insufficiency of facts or the law does not cover this situation, and therefore we're going to ask for a dismissal of all or some of the charges.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jed is with us in Lacouture. Jed, hi.
Bonjour.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
Well, just seems like more of the same to me, and the sadness is that the same hasn't been working. So my gut feeling is that if something wasn't working then, it's not all of a sudden going to work now. And I just feel like there's got to be better ways for our time, energy, and resources. It's just really unfortunate because there's very real things happening to real people nowadays. And, you know, the payments were made in 16, the affair in 06, and here we are in 23. And so that's 17 years now. And it's just like,
I gotcha, Jed. Point taken. I think, David, Jed, making the case that even if we ultimately agree that illegal things were done here, is this the best use of our prosecutorial and court resources to prosecute this particular alleged crime?
Well, that's a good question here. Now, we can sort of cut it in a couple of ways. One of them is to say that this is New York City. This is where, I think the prosecutor pointed out, it's the financial center of the United States, if not of the world, that if we don't take seriously financial fraud and bank fraud, or I say financial business fraud there, you know, what repercussions it have across the country? Because in some sense, the way we can describe it here, take Donald Trump's name off of this, this is just another business fraud case. And should we be prosecuting white collar crimes? I would say we probably should. Now, if you're coming back and saying that so much time has passed, well, the reason why they couldn't bring this case before is that when he was president, the interpretation is a sitting president can't be indicted. And maybe it just took them time to gather all this evidence to come to bear. But you still raise a good question here. With all the different things going on in the world, might there be a better use of prosecutorial resources in this? And I think it's a fair question, and people get to raise that in terms of saying, should they be going after more murderers, drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a legitimate criticism that could be looked at.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Allison is with us now in Waukesha. Allison, hi.
Hi. My thoughts on this are, if this actually did go all the way to a trial, who in the world could they actually get to be on the jury if they're looking for, you know, an unbiased person? There's not one citizen in this entire country that doesn't have some sort of opinion one way or the other about Donald Trump.
Allison, thanks for the call. And yeah, in Manhattan, David, let's find somebody without strong prejudgments potentially of Donald Trump. How difficult a task might that be to fill that jury?
That could be difficult. I was going to say, not just in Manhattan, but across the United States, but certainly in Manhattan. Okay, I'm in Minnesota, where, for example, about a couple of years ago, Derek Chauvin was on trial, you know, for the murder of George Floyd. And everybody said it's going to be impossible to find an impartial jury because of the pretrial coverage. And we managed to do it, because what the standard is going to be is not that you've not heard about Donald Trump, but are you open to hearing the facts, open to hearing the law, and can you render an impartial judgment based on that? Not that you've heard about the facts, but can you render an impartial judgment here? So that's going to still be a difficult call here, but I was going to say, I forget what the number is. There's probably 4 or 5 million adults in Manhattan. It'll be tough, but I think they'll be able to find, you know, 12 to 15 people who will say that they can do that.
Thanks for the call, Allison. Larry is with us now in Dodgeville. Hi, Larry.
Yes, I was wondering, would there be any type of statute of limitations to these charges versus when some of the first payments were made, all the way up to the end of the last payments, and as far as a trial that were to start? Is there any type of time limit for that stuff?
Larry, thanks for the call. My understanding, David, in New York is the clock kind of stops on statute of limitations for someone who's living out of state for a while, say at the White House. Do you see statute of limitations coming up here?
I do not see statute of limitations coming up for exactly the reason that you pointed out, is that under New York state law, it's not until you basically come back to the state that the clock statute of limitations kicks in. And you're right. He was living in Washington, D.C. He was living in Florida. At some point, I can't remember when it was, he changed his official residence from Manhattan to Florida. So we don't face a problem there. And once he's been indicted, there's no longer a statute of limitations issue because they brought the charges. And even if it takes a year or so to actually do the trial, we're no longer in danger of that issue.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Tony joins us now in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If he is jailed, which we all don't believe he ever will be, would the Secret Service have to serve time with him in prison?
Tony, thanks for the call. Now, we saw already logistical issues, a lot of arrangements made for exactly that reason in Trump's court appearance today. Can you talk about the questions that a potential prison time for a former president might bring up, David?
Well, first off, it's funny you ask that because my students and I were talking about that today too. The first answer is to say we don't know. The second answer would be probably, let's say he were convicted of a felony. Given the fact that he's a white-collar criminal, I doubt he's going to Sing Sing. I doubt he's going to Attica in New York. It will be probably one of the other facilities that deal with white-collar criminals, and there'll be ample security there to keep him safe. At least we presume there will be. So I don't think we're going to see the Secret Service at the prison with him.
Tony, thanks for the call. Now, obviously, that's a lot of time between here and something like that even being a possibility. David, what happens next? This isn't going to be over in the next week or two, most likely.
Absolutely correct. So we had the arraignment today in which it was just a plea of guilty or not guilty, not guilty. They were not allowed, that is the Trump attorneys, to be able to file any motions. Look to see a couple of things happening. The first thing will be meeting with the prosecution to lay out a schedule. That schedule will be for when motions have to be filed, such as dismissal of the case. It'll be for when the prosecution has to turn over evidence. It will be about all the pretrial matters and pretrial hearings that will occur. So that's going to start to unfold over the next few weeks. Again, I heard something at some point during the course of the day, maybe you heard the same thing that I did, that the anticipation is the trial probably would not be for about a year. And that's about average that what we would say for most trials in the United States is that from time of arraignment to an actual trial, it could take 6, 9 months or a year. And if we do some calendar here now, that would put us, let's say it's a year, around March or April of 2024. That's in the middle of the primary season. And I was going to ask here, I'm guessing that the presidential primary in Wisconsin next year is probably somewhere around, what, April or something like that.
I haven't looked at the calendar. David, as we wrap up, I mean, the payments, as we learned from the Michael Cohen conviction, were made so that Stormy Daniels didn't tell her, make her allegations in the run-up to a presidential election. We could end up with Stormy Daniels under oath in a public court hearing in the middle of the primaries, talking about that very thing. Your thoughts on that in our last minute?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, she could be testifying regarding, basically, potentially an extramarital affair that she had with Donald Trump about the payouts. And this is going to be the issue when they have a trial. Let's say Donald Trump does testify. You have Trump testifying, say, no, I didn't do this. Stormy Daniels is going to say yes. Michael Cohen, who is Donald Trump's attorney, is going to say something else. As a jury, how do you weigh all these competing he said, she says, et cetera, to make a decision? That is going to be a tough job, I think, for a jury.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He talked to us about what we learned today about the charges against former President Donald Trump and what we can expect next in the case. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, AR-15-style firearms boomed in sales and popularity in recent years, and it became a weapon of choice in many high-profile mass shootings. We'll look at an in-depth investigation into the rise of the new breed of firearms. And we'll find out what today's state Supreme Court election outcome means for high-profile issues and cases here in Wisconsin. Our own Sean Johnson will join us, and as always, you can join in with your reactions to whatever ends up happening. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.